Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Hey, everyone. Have you been to the Organic Gardener Podcast website and signed up for our email list? If you go there, you will get my new PDF, 7 Awesome Ways to Find More Time in Your Garden. And it's just some tips that I've learned from listening to my amazing guests who are always sharing with us super effective ways to be a better gardener. So if you head over to the organicgardenerpodcast.com and enter your email, you'll get 7 awesome ways to find more time in your garden. You can also get a copy of our ebook of Organic Gardening Basics. And just all the show notes are there, all the links to our show. So, and I'll be sending out some Golden Seeds newsletters as I get them done. And of course, you'll get a special invitation to join the Organic Gardener Podcast Facebook community. Hope to see you there. The Organic Gardener Podcast is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health conscious people like runners, gardeners, healthy eaters, strength trainers, and green future growers just like you get lower rates on their life insurance. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/OGP or mention the promo code OGP when you talk to a Health IQ agent to save up to 33% on your life insurance. To the Organic Gardener Podcast today. I am just thrilled to introduce my featured guest from Three Hearts Farm in Bozeman, Montana, Rachel Hicks. So welcome to the show, Rachel.
Thank you. Thank you, Jackie. I'm excited to visit with you.
So I'm talking with Rachel because last summer when I was at a teacher training in Bozeman, I went to the Bozeman Farmers Market. And I talked to one of the people that works with her from Three Hearts Farm and asked them if they would come and tell us about their farm and their journey. So that's how we connected. And so Rachel, we were actually talking in the pre-chat. Rachel grew up south of me. So Bozeman is like on the other side of the Rocky Mountains about, oh, I don't know, probably 200 miles, what? 200 miles east of, or yeah, east of Missoula.
Yeah.
And then Missoula is like 200 miles south of me. And so it's a little bit of a different area, but it's a very popular college town. They have lots of technology jobs growing, one of the biggest growing populations in Montana. And it's just beautiful.
Yeah.
My mom and brother came out to a children's book conference in Bozeman a few years ago. And that was like the first time I really got to explore it. And I just fell in love with Bozeman. So, anyway, I'll be quiet and I'll let you talk. So do you want to just like kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and your background and how you got to Bozeman and the Three Hearts Farm?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure. So I grew up in Moise, north of Missoula, close to the Bison Range. And we did a lot of gardening there and outside work, and we were in 4-H and that kind of thing. And then after I was married, Josh and I moved. Well, we spent 3 years in Harrison, and then we spent some years in Ronan. And while we were in Ronan on a much smaller farm with our own family garden, then Josh's aunt and uncle had an opportunity to buy Three Hearts Farm.
Oh.
And they asked us, if we would be interested in managing the farm. And we said, yes. They gave us the opportunity to manage it and then to work into eventually owning it as well. So we're still in that process of getting there, but we're here. We moved to Three Hearts Farm to Bozeman. We moved a year ago from last June, and we've been here for about 18 months now, and have really learned a lot of things about Bozeman and about gardening, and are really enjoying it and enjoying the community here. We have 4 boys. The oldest is 11 and the youngest is 3. And we enjoy teaching them about gardening and about working with people and helping at farmers markets and all those kinds of things. So yeah, we have a milk cow, and we really enjoy her, and we have some ducks, and those are our primary animals right now, but we enjoy animals as well. So yeah, that's a little bit about us.
Awesome. Well, so I kind of always like to ask about your very first gardening experience. I mean, it sounds like you kind of grew up maybe on a farm type atmosphere, but like, you know, who are you with?
Yes.
What'd you grow? Like, how old were you?
Yes. Yeah. So I always remember working in the garden. I remember sitting and I was with my parents and my brothers and sisters, and we would sit and, you know, we would pod peas for hours on end while Dad read a story to us, and or we would snap beans, or we would, I don't know, remember being up late at night processing corn so we could freeze it with my mom and my sister, and just the crazy things that you do because gardening season just happens that way, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, and we had... my brothers and sister and I, we had, you know, chores in the garden where we were weeding, or, you know, probably some of my favorite times were planting seeds with my dad early on. So we just did a lot of gardening during the summer and growing up. Those would be my first gardening memories. Yeah.
I love that. I've always pictured Mike and I sitting on a porch shelling peas with the grandkids sitting there. So,
yes. Yes.
That's
yes.
A wonderful memory.
I feel very blessed to have had that growing up, because I don't think a lot of children do, and I think it gives us a real appreciation and connection to the land around us and how it feeds us and how we can take care of it. Really important things, and I hope that we're sharing those and passing those on to our children as well.
Aww, I love that. Can I ask, so like, I have a real thing, fondness for millennials. Are you a millennial? I guess if you have an 11-year-old son, you could still be in a millennial, couldn't you?
Maybe, I don't know.
I figure millennials are born between 1980 and 1995.
Okay, I was born in 1973, so I'm a little pre-millennial.
Okay, and just, I just love the way you talk about all of that, and just, that's so true. And that's what makes my show so successful, like I was saying in the pre-chat, is because my guests are, you know, green future growers, people who have a vision for, you know, a healthy planet, and who, you know, take time to enjoy those rituals with their children, and, you know, just caring about our earth and those connections. So,
yes.
I'm glad you're here to share with us today. So how did you, is that how you learned how to garden organically, from your parents, or was it some other place, or like?
Yeah. You know, I think I started learning about gardening organically as we were growing up. I think it's been a journey. I know when we were living in Harrison, I met another woman who's become a good friend, Jenny Carl, and she really introduced me to some other organic gardeners and to the idea of really paying attention to the soil and treating the soil, I think, as a living organism as well, and thinking about how to take care of the soil, because it's so important for growing really healthy, nutritious food for us as well. And so I think it's been a process. And since we've come to Bozeman, I continue to learn. I don't feel like I've kind of arrived at the best way to garden organically.
I know, and it's getting more challenging every year as the climate changes and our seasons change, and the soil's doing mm-hmm. things. Like, my husband's constantly talking about how different it is than, you know, what it was just even 10 years ago, and all
yeah,
the things
sure.
that you have to. And I think a lot of, you know, there's a big conversation among farmers about resiliency right now, and gardeners, and, you know, how are
mm-hmm.
we going to make the best of
mm-hmm.
climate change and, you know, helping
mm-hmm.
our planet. So, And then for sure, soil health has been the biggest, you know, talking point on my show, that it, that nutrient dense food all starts with healthy soil. So, and I'm actually on my interview that I'm going to do this afternoon, I'm going to talk about organic fertilizers and compost and the different places that you would use those things in different methods. So do you have anything that you want to share about how you keep your soil healthy?
Yeah, I feel it. So we're really working on developing a system for maintaining healthy soil here in our particular area, on our particular land. And there isn't a real system that's set in place. And I say system, not that it's really rigid, but there's been some cover cropping that's been done and then tilling that in. There's been some kind of manure applications at various times, but nothing that's really kind of consistent and in a good cycle or rotation. So I think we're really working on trying to develop diverse cover crops, and really expand and explore that, and also allowing for a rotation where we're not just rotating vegetable crops, but we're also rotating land in and out of production so that there are periods of time when the land is growing a cover crop and then it's being grazed by animals, and then it's maybe growing another, like a series of cover crops, and then before it's tilled under and put back into vegetable production. So I think those kinds of things, as well as looking for other sources of manure. You just have to be so careful these days what you bring into your land, because it's hard to know what it's carrying with it as far as herbicides or pesticides or things that have a long residual with it. So I've been really trying to explore ways of regenerating our land with just the practices that we have here and minimal inputs from outside.
Okay. Can I start by asking, how big is your place? Like an acre, 10 acres, a quarter acre? Like how big is...
Yeah. Three Hearts Farm is a... we have 20 acres, and there are... there's a deer fencing, and there's been land opened up that's for market gardening. That's about between 3 and 4 acres, and probably close to between a half an acre and another acre of land in greenhouses or hard houses, some type of protected land. So we're looking at, we're actually looking at reducing probably the amount of land that we're putting into practice so that we're actually gardening between 1 and 2 acres, and the rest of that land, the other 3 acres or so, would be in cover crop and rotating through different cover crops and along with animal grazing, and then having the heart, and in addition having the hard houses and the hoop houses that we have, the high tunnels that we have, putting those in some type of a rotation as well. Yeah.
Awesome. You're just dropping lots of golden seeds for listeners. So one thing, I've been like teaching this kind of, or running this beta study group of, Anna Hess wrote this little primer about cover crops called, homegrown humus. But so I've been learning a lot about it. Mike and I have like barely, or Mike basically is the gardener here, so he's like barely kind of implemented it. He's been bugging me to get him seeds, which always seems to be the hard part. But do you want to tell listeners who maybe aren't as familiar with what is a cover crop, like what that is, and what maybe some examples of what you're using and how that whole rotation piece works?
Yes. I feel really inexperienced at this myself as well, so maybe that's helpful. I don't know. So I think of a cover crop as a crop that you plant often, what could be any time of the year, really, that you seed at any time of the year, but there are different crops that you would seed depending upon the type of year, time of year. So we seeded, and I think other farmers in this area do this as well. We seeded some winter rye and some hairy vetch in September. And we're looking for that to kind of overwinter and start growing early in the spring. And then we'd like for that to get, for that crop to actually get pretty tall and to where it's setting, it's starting to actually set seeds, but maybe not quite mature enough to where those seeds are viable yet for the winter rye. And then bringing animals in, whether they be cows or sheep, and maybe cows and sheep, and then followed by some kind of chickens or ducks. Even after that, you know, so you kind of have two sets of animals moving across it and grazing that down. And that would happen in June when you've when it's really grown and put some, you know, a lot of, so that they're, so the animals are kind of eating it, but also crushing a lot of it back into the ground, a lot of really good organic matter. And then working on seeding something like buckwheat over that, which could come really quickly, or some kind of an oats and a peas would be also a really good combination of cover crops, and always trying to have like a some kind of a cereal grain along with some kind of a legume together, kind of pairing. And then so that second cover crop would grow then into the probably into August, maybe in September, at which time you would either graze it again or mow it and then seed it again for a second fall crop. Or if you terminated it early enough, that second crop, you and seeded like you could seed kind of a fall cover crop that that would grow up and then it would winter kill. So if you seeded it in August in our area, probably, I think it would probably have to be August in our area. We tried in September, but I don't feel like it really got tall enough. So I think you would have to seed it in August, and then it would winter kill with the frost in, you know, October, November, December, in that time. So you could almost have three cover crops. And then the following spring, hopefully it would be ready for you to kind of to prepare the soil and start planting for vegetables that second season. So those are kind of some of the things. There are lots of other, I'd really like to get into putting, say, down between my vegetable rows, feeding the kinds of clovers that are, that do well kind of in walkways and are legumes that kind of that add into the nutrition of the soil. And there are understory cover crops. So if you, once you transplant things like your brassicas in, then you can seed in these smaller, lower kind of growing clovers or things like that that would, that'll kind of actually grow along with the other crop, the vegetable crop. And that can be, now that's a little bit of a different, it's kind of more intercropping rather than cover cropping. But the idea, I think, for the cover cropping is that you're trying to keep plants growing on the soil all the time, because as they're growing, they're feeding the soil, and trying to do a number of crops. And this is at least the direction that we're moving in. I know it has, we're moving in a direction of more, less tillage, lower tillage, so that as those roots are growing, they're helping the soil biology, the fungal networks and that kind of thing grow and develop. And so the longer that we can let that soil go without tilling it, and the longer we keep those cover crops growing, I think the healthier it is for the whole system.
That's so true. And so I just want to mention to listeners, like, even though Rachel's talking about their farm, and this might seem like a lot, The primer that I'm reading, that homegrown humus book, is for backyard gardeners. And she constantly talks about, so you could do this even if you just have like a small bed. And then I also like the reason I even started the homegrown humus book or bought it or even like looked into it was I talked to this woman, Jess Pierce, who's down in Southern California. And she works at the John Jevons Research Institute or something, I think. And she talked about how he wrote a book about planting, you know, growing enough food, just like in your backyard to feed your family in a year. And what surprised me about my conversation with her was that they said 60% of what they grow was cover crops and was grown to build the soil. And that's when I really was like surprised and really got interested because like you said, we have a really hard time finding enough manure and enough things to add. Like my husband built this little thing I call the mini farm, which is like a quarter to a third of an acre, and we've had enough problems just trying to do our little garden but outside of our house. So he's got that huge thing there, and you know, just trying to find stuff to create that healthy soil. So that's kind of how we got interested in it too. And then like you were talking about the no-till, like I had never even heard of no-till till I started my podcast 2 years ago, and now, you know, that seems to be the way everybody's going.
No, I would agree. I think that it's fairly new to us as well, and so trying to find how it works with our particular situation, we're just jumping to really try and see how we can make it work and how the timing and all that works. Definitely.
Cool. So do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Sure. I feel like we had a really great crop of garlic this year. And I honestly don't know exactly why it was, but we think it was planted at a good time and it liked the season. Like the place it was, and I don't know, it was just really an amazing crop of garlic. It was really fun to go out and harvest it and to see how well it's doing at this time. So that did really well. We also had some really great tomatoes in our greenhouses this year, so that was fun too. And many people love tomatoes, and our family is no exception to that. We really enjoy tomatoes and eating them fresh. And those were two things that really stood out to me that did really well. We had other things that did well as well, but those especially were wonderful this year. Such a blessing.
Okay. So tomatoes. I've been telling Mike, so I interviewed this guy, David Wolverton from Arlie. He sells at the Arlie Farmers Market. And he talks about starting his tomatoes in December and in the greenhouse. Wow. So like, how early do you start them? And you're putting them in the greenhouse. And then I also talked to Richard Wiswell, who's like wrote the Organic Farmers Business Handbook over in Vermont. Yeah. And he talks about keeping the tomatoes in the greenhouse all year long, because he says that gives them the prime environment that they like. But like in Montana, Mike and I, we just struggle to get our tomatoes to get ripe. So do you have like some secrets for what's worked well, and when do you plant them?
Yes. We don't keep our tomatoes all through the year. We would have to heat our houses or have some pretty, we would have to have some supplemental heat to keep our, and I think we would also have to provide supplemental light for our tomatoes, because I don't think we have enough daylight to sweeten them up once, you know, they really start slowing down kind of mid-September.
Keeps them in the greenhouse in December, or the David who starts them in Montana, so that he has, because what happened was I was at the Missoula Farmers Market in like June, and this woman had tomatoes, and I'm like, how in the world do you have tomatoes? And she's like, oh, well, I get my plants from David over there, who keeps them in his greenhouse and starts them. And he actually starts the flats indoors in his living room, I think, in December, and then kind of moves them out into the greenhouse by February. And I thought, how could you possibly afford to heat a greenhouse in Montana? But their tomatoes, right. I mean, they weren't inexpensive, but they weren't like, you know, astronomical. They were affordable. In fact, right. they were the size and how fresh they looked in June. They were probably totally worth the price. But so what do you usually start?
No, I think that's a little bit earlier than when we do. We usually start ours kind of the end of February, middle to end of February. And we will seed in a smaller, it's one of our hard houses, so it has that double layer of hard plastic, you know, so that it's a little bit more insulated than a plastic hoop house, you know?
No, so I was going to ask you, what is a hard house? I don't really know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I'm sorry, that's maybe not a common technology or terminology. You can get hard plastic. It's like greenhouse plastic, and it comes in sheets like metal roofing, but it's plastic, and it's kind of a double layer plastic. So it has that layer of insulating air kind of between those two layers of plastic. Yeah. Yeah. So it's just hard. It's hard plastic instead of soft plastic. And those houses are smaller. And actually, I feel like we have a significant amount of sunlight here. Yeah. You know, the Mission Valley where I grew up, they're often cloudy. Right. Their solar energy is a lot less, I think, even though they're probably not quite as cold as we are. But that solar energy here can really help to heat the houses. So, and we do have electric heaters in that hard house where we start our tomatoes. So we'll start them in February. And, you know, we transplant them once, so they go into a 3 or 4 inch size pot. And then from there, they go into the kind of the end of April, beginning of May, they'll go into the greenhouses, the hoop houses, so the taller plastic hoop houses. And you know, we do have to be careful because even in May, we can get a pretty hard frost that can damage them. So once they're in there this last season, we covered them with row cover inside the hoop house. Yeah.
Now,
and
do your hoop houses have ends on them? Like, are they sealed? And are those hard houses sealed? Like, all the way? They must be if you have heaters in them. But what about the hoop houses? Are the ends open or are they closed?
Well, they could be closed better. They're, you know, they have we have a couple different styles. So one has a sliding. They have hard. The one house, has the hard plastic on the ends, and it has a sliding door that opens and closes. And the other long hoop house that we have has ends that we roll up, so it has plastic. They're not very well insulated, but you'd be surprised at how much solar energy they gather, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does pretty well. We don't have ripe tomatoes maybe by the end of June, but definitely in July we'll have ripe tomatoes. So they're not quite as early, you know, but they're getting there.
Do you save your seeds?
No, I would like to. I don't. I might work into that. You know, you have to start things kind of one thing at a time, right? But I think that I think that's another great way of, you talked about adjusting to the climate, is saving seeds, because I think plants can adjust and can adapt to their climate. You start finding certain varieties that that grow really well in the climate that you have in your particular area. And climates can really vary there can be microclimates that really vary within pretty small distances, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a great idea to save seeds. I haven't gotten there yet.
How about, do you have any, because somebody, a listener asked me the other day about, somebody had recommended tomato varieties and I couldn't pinpoint what episode she was talking about. So do you have like any, she ended up buying that Epic Tomatoes book, which I have interviewed that guy, I just haven't posted it yet, but do you have any varieties that you really like?
You know, the varieties that we grow might vary. You might like want one variety for a greenhouse if you're going to grow things in a hoop house. You might want a little different variety if you're going to grow it actually out in your garden.
How about something that you're excited to do different or something new you're going to try next year?
Yes. I was talking a little bit about intercropping. I would like to try some kind of intercropping, and I haven't pinpointed exactly what that is, but I would like to say when you're growing kale, then to grow, I would like to try to put like a little clover underneath the kale, you know, to see if that would help the kale, you know. And maybe try things like radishes in between onions or something, or radish, maybe that's not a good example because those are two roots, but radishes in between lettuce, you know, where maybe you're harvesting a head of lettuce and then you've got radishes kind of alternating rows in there. I'd really like to try some intercropping. Does that, yep. You know, I need to look at my book. There's a book that's written, it's called Carrots Love Tomatoes, and I forget the author's name. I should have brought it over with me. But there, she has lots of suggestions about plants that actually do well next to each other, you know?
Yeah, like companion planting. Yeah. I love all of that because one thing I was going to say that we didn't mention when you were talking about cover crops is if you're doing this intercropping thing, it probably keeps the weeds way down because you're not having any empty soil for weeds to grow. You know, everything
that is definitely
growing you want. The other thing I was going to say is, I planted this little mini salad bed garden in my windowsill this fall that's doing really well. And I have like arugula growing and some black seeded Simpson lettuce and then a lot of herbs. And I've been like trying to get myself to every week plant a new set of arugula leaves because when I was in Paris 2 years ago, the first day I got there, I got breakfast at this restaurant and it was eggs with a side salad of arugula. And it was just these itty bitty tiny baby leaves. And I have just been in love with that ever since. And so I'm picking like the itty bittiest tiny, they're like little miniature hearts the size of my pinky. And I'll pick like, you know, 12 of those. But what they do to a bowl of soup is just incredible. And so I've been like interplanting the arugula with the lettuce in my little windowsill. And it's just been the greatest. Yes. So I love what you're saying about intercropping. So how about... go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that our bodies also change with the seasons. And I think there are those kinds of greens taste amazing during the wintertime because that's when we're really craving that kind of food, you know? I think our body needs it.
I think you're so right. And I am like so excited how my garden's doing because I was worried exactly what you said, that there wasn't going to be enough daylight. I don't know how many times I've tried to plant a basil plant in the fall and Mike is laughing at me, or like in December. And I'm like, he's like, that's not going to grow right now. You can't start your basil. But it's probably because maybe that's when it usually dies or it's getting old enough that, because I almost always have a basil plant in my windowsill. So it's really nice over there. My rosemary plant just died. I put my rosemary plant in the windowsill. I had it on my kitchen sink and I put it over there with all the other herbs and for the weekend, and I came back and it was just dead. I mean, it just kind of slowly died, but most of it was dead. I don't know if it got too cold, but Mike thinks it just got too bright over there. So I'm so bummed about that. I cannot keep rosemary alive. And I thought this was the plant that was going to do it. It was doing so good. And it just happened 2 weeks ago. Right. So I don't know, but yeah, it's so nice to have just a little bit of fresh herbs right in at my
head. Yeah.
So, and I think you're right about that. Like, we don't really buy tomatoes anymore in the winter. Like, I just use Mike's pickled beets on my salads, and it's a very different taste, but I don't know. Yep. That just works for the red for me. So I think you're really, you hit the nail on the head there. So this is the part of the show. Or wait, no, I have one more question. Sorry. How about something that didn't work so well this season? Like, was there something that didn't go the way you thought it was going to go?
Yeah. I looked at that question earlier, too. I love growing pumpkins and winter squash. Ooh. And I feel like they didn't really do that well this year. Maybe it was kind of a combination of, We transplanted them out. So we do start the seeds in the seed house again so that we can get a little bit of an earlier start on it.
Yeah.
And we transplanted them out probably early June, and we got a late frost that did not kill the plants, thankfully, but I think it really set them back. And then I think also we didn't get in and get on top of weeding it. Oh. And so I think there was a little bit of weed stress as well. Not so much early on, but kind of mid-season, when everything, you know, gardening seems to really peak and then everything needs to be done at once,
right.
You know. And then, yeah. And then the last thing is that I'm realizing that on this larger scale, watering is really crucial, and different plants need different, they need a different kind of watering cycle. And so we had our squash kind of all in the same water line as like greens, which need kind of a lot more water. And I feel like, I don't know, they just didn't like it. They didn't do that well. We got some, you know, and I'm thankful for what we got and what, you know, the pumpkins that we had and the squash that we have taste pretty good, you know, but there wasn't very many and the plants didn't look so strong. So that was kind of a bummer.
So we can hardly ever get pumpkins to grow. Like, do you have any secrets for like a different year when you were successful?
Do you seed them do you start them inside? Do you start them in a covered area?
I think he does.
Yeah. I don't know.
I'm sure he does.
Think pumpkins like mulch. I don't know if he's used like a mulch around them. You know, I think they kind of like that. I think, and I don't know if you have real swings in temperatures. I think that you might have really hot days, but then at least in Bozeman, we get really cold nights. It's not uncommon, I feel like, for it to be 40 kind of most of the summer, in the high 40s, but, you know, or low 50s almost all summer long. I think that's kind of hard on those crops sometimes, you know, that swing. But so maybe some mulch would help, you know, that even if you had some of that ground cover cloth to kind of hold in the heat a little better, that might help, you know. I also know that my best, not here because I don't have a real compost pile here, but I used to have a compost pile where I would just pile the manure and the straw from the cows during the wintertime. And then it looks always kind of messy in the summertime. So I would just seed, my pumpkins and my squash on top of that. And it was wonderful because they would grow and just cover the whole pile, but they really loved, I think they loved the nutrients in that pile as well. So I think they kind of like a lot, you know, some nice rich soil as well.
Okay.
Those would be my suggestions. Yeah, I don't have a great.
You know what I wanted to ask you? Like, how big is like the produce that you provide? Like, do you have a CSA? Like, what do you take to the farmer's market? Like, how much are you guys producing?
Yeah, we, you know, we can produce quite a lot. I would say at peak season, we're producing, boy, I would say 300 pounds of tomatoes twice a week, maybe.
No way.
And it's a lot of tomatoes. Yeah, we do a lot of tomatoes. And then we do have, this last year, we had about between 70 and 80 CSA members. And we produced for about 4 or 5 restaurants. Not a lot, you know, but some. And then there were a couple of grocery stores that we would provide, especially kale and radishes to them, like bunch radishes and bunches of kale and bunches of chard. And then, you know, so we could be, to give you an example, probably between 5 and 6 on average cases of kale per week. And then there are a couple of distributors. One is a business called Root Cellar Foods, and she gathers local produce, and then she will wash it and process it for typically other institutions in the area that want a product that's more prepared, you know, more ready to just use, either cook or serve. So, cool. We produce, it's not as much as some of the other farms in the area, but it's still a significant amount. Yeah, it's fun. It's good.
And maybe you could hook me up with that Root Cellar Foods woman. She sounds like she'd be a cool person to interview.
Sure. Yeah, her name is Christina Angel. And yeah, I'd be happy to give you her contact information.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm sure she has quite a story. And she's been in the area for quite a few years now. And I think she's seen some changes in the trends, I guess, or in the willingness of people to work with local, because working with local producers has its own kind of unique situations, and they're not always as, you know, you can't really get tomatoes locally, at least here in Bozeman. It's not as easy as, you know, to get them in the middle of winter, as, you know, so you just have to kind of plan your menus around that.
Do you provide for that Farm to Tractor pizza place? I love their food.
Yes, we do. Red Tractor Pizza.
Oh, yeah, Red Tractor Pizza. So what are some of the things restaurants, like if somebody is thinking about, you know, starting a farm or market farming or getting into, like what are some successful things you found that restaurants like?
You know, I would really suggest talking to the particular restaurant that you have in mind and seeing if you can work out something there. What would be helpful for their, you know, we've talked at there are a number of different restaurants, such as, well, the pizza place, and then there's another Italian restaurant. So they really like tomatoes. That tends to be one of our main crops that we grow for restaurants. I would just talk, if you want to specifically grow for a restaurant, I would really suggest you go in and talk to them and see, maybe take some of your produce in so they can see what it is. And sometimes people have to taste it before they're, you know, willing to kind of switch over and make that commitment. We have one particular restaurant. It's really wonderful. He says, okay, I want you just to provide, you know, X amount of dollars worth of produce for me every week, and I will take it and cook with it. And it's wonderful because then we can find things that we really, that are really available and doing well at that time, and share kind of the best with him and provide the best for him with that, you know. It gives us a little bit of flexibility that way, which is really helpful because, you know, things don't always ripen at the same time every year. I would suggest that. I would also suggest going to a farmer's market, I think. Try to get a little booth at a farmer's market and work on selling your produce there. I think it really gives you a sense for what is happening with other farms in your area, and also for the pricing in your area as well.
Before we get to the root of things, let's take a minute to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. The Organic Gardener podcast is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like redners, gardeners, healthy eaters, vegetarians, and green future growers just like you get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/OGP to support the show and see if you qualify. Over half of Health IQ customers save between 4 to 33% on their life insurance. These savings are exclusive to Health IQ customers because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, a 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people just like you, green future growers. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/OGP or mention the promo code OGP when you talk to a Health IQ agent. FreeGardenCourse.com. Mike and I have developed some lessons to help you create your very own organic oasis. We'll guide you through the steps to build your perfect natural landscape, an edible earth-friendly yard, a sustainable deep-bed garden, or even start a small profitable market farm. We'll show you how to save time, lower your produce bill, collect usable data, eat healthy, nutritious food with minimal labor, use the most effective and efficient production methods currently being used in backyard gardens as well as market farms, and maybe even help you find some profitable markets. We've designed it to save you time, lower your produce bill, and help you eat healthy, nutritious food. There's checklists, there's outside reading, video assignments. You can join the online Facebook community where there's lots of people from around the world to help you get your garden started today. So remember, freegardencourse.com. This is kind of where I get to the part that we call getting to the root of things. It's kind of like a lightning round in other podcasts. And then these are just kind of shorter questions. Like, do you have like a least favorite activity to do? Like, is there something you have to force yourself to get out there and do?
I have a hard time going out and starting the pump because sometimes it doesn't work when I go to start the pump so I can irrigate the field. That's probably my least favorite. I don't like fixing pipes.
I can totally relate to that. You know what I was going to say about you said about watering before is that that guy Richard Wiswell I was telling you about that wrote the Organic Farmer's Business book, he talked about watering is key and that making sure that your vegetables that do need water or your fruit trees or whatever that needs water, like that can triple your production, just making sure you provide the right water. So I thought that was a key thing that you talked about. And we're, I totally relate to that because we're having a problem with our pump at our house. So dealing with pumps is, I don't even know. I told Mike last weekend, I'm like, you should show me what you're doing down there just in case. So he has to go fix the primer or something. I don't know. So on the flip side, what's your favorite activity to do?
I love picking tomatoes. That's probably one of my favorite things to do.
Nice.
Because I usually sample a little bit as you go at the end, at least, you know?
Yeah, I just sample all the time when I go to the garden. And I love cherry tomatoes because I like to just go pick cherry tomatoes. I'm a much bigger cherry tomato fan. How about what's the best gardening?
I was going to say I like having my children work in the garden and then being able to say, sure, let's sample on this so that you're hungry. Let's eat something. You know, it's wonderful.
Yeah. My students at school, so I teach over in Browning during the school year, which is why we're talking today, the day before Thanksgiving, because it's like the only day I have off. And they have been bugging me because we get snack through the food program 2-3 days a week. And those other 2 days, you know, the snack buzzer goes off and they're like, well, where's snack? And I'm like, well, they didn't bring us anything today. And like at the beginning of the year, we had tons of carrots and I was bringing them in those green beans and they have been so missing the snacks and things. And they're like, how come you don't bring us snack? And Mike bought them 2 boxes of apples from a local orchard here. And like, why don't you bring us snacks anymore? And I'm like, garden season's over. But kids love fresh vegetables. I'm so disappointed with this new administration and their theory that the kids just throw the vegetables away. They do not throw them away at our school. Those kids love snack in the afternoon. And they have like a fruit and salad bar at lunch. And the kids all pick one fruit and one salad item, you know, either carrot sticks or lettuce or tomatoes. And they love it. They eat a lot of vegetables.
That's wonderful, especially if they taste good. I think that
and if they help plant them,
better yet.
Yeah, and like you said, if they taste good and they're fresh, compared to like sometimes, you know, the snack things, you get those little carrot tips in the bags that are kind of all watery, and I'm surprised at how much food they get in little plastic baggies, so. But anyway, we're trying. They actually started this big farm-to-school grant program, and they're really going to try to make a connection between, and the woman who's in charge of the food purchasing tries to buy a lot, as much local produce, and they have two, you know, like Amish Hutterite colonies that they can get a lot of food from. So it's really nice. They're definitely trying.
Yes.
What's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
I had a friend years ago, and she was an amazing, she still is an amazing gardener. And she said, don't plant more than what you can take care of.
Sure.
It's really hard not to do.
Yeah.
But then, yeah, so that was, I thought that was well, well spoken, you know?
Yeah, because we all kind of get that like spring fever and we're like, let's get some of these and let's put some of these seeds in. And when you put it in the beginning, it seems like you have all this big bare space and you forget how much it's going to take. And then like you were saying about watering in the hot of summer and we're tired of weeding, and you know, that's the biggest secret to failure is, you know, just overwhelming yourself. So I think that's great advice. How about a favorite tool? If you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Yes. So probably one of my favorite tools is the little stirrup hoe. I really enjoy that. It seems that it's good for my body. It's not, I don't have to bend down so much, and it's, but if I'm to move and just take one tool, I think I would take a spading fork, because it's just easier to work the ground with that, you know?
No, and what's a spading fork? Like a broad fork?
It's not quite like a broad. I think a broad fork is bigger and more heavy duty. A spading fork is just a smaller fork, and it's like a shovel, but it's, I tend to have a lot of areas that have clack grass in it, and so a spading fork really pulls out, sifts out the roots, and then you can just get those out. It's really, anyway. Yeah, it's a good
tool.
No, tell
me more. I'm going to get one for Mike for Christmas, because quack grass is like his biggest enemy, if he had an enemy.
Yeah.
Like he's always digging out every last piece of quack grass. A spading fork.
Yeah.
Maybe if you have a picture, I could grab a picture of that. I got to get him one of those.
Okay.
I don't think we have one. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, interesting. So it looks like a pitchfork, but it's heavier duty. And you can stand on it like a shovel to poke it into the ground. But the handle is typically shorter than a shovel handle. It's not as tall. It's not as long. Because you tend to spade the ground, you tend to kind of step in and loosen the dirt like a shovel would. But then you can, the dirt will kind of go through and it'll kind of pull up. The forks will kind of pull up the roots. The quack grass has those really long roots. It'll pull those up and you can grab them out better, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
How about a favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden? What do your kids love? No, what do you love? Either one.
Yeah, both. So one of the things that we really love, and my kids will actually do this for me too, is we'll take onions from the garden and we'll chop them and just saute them down until they're kind of caramelized with olive oil and salt and pepper. They really like to do that. We had a recipe that's called peppernata. So you do something similar with peppers. Well, they'll do it with onions. They'll just call it onionata.
Oh, yum. And I love peppernata.
Yeah. And the other thing that we really love is just tomatoes with, slice your tomatoes with a little olive oil and vinegar. It's really in salt and pepper. So simple, a little bit of fresh basil on top, but it's so delicious.
Yum. Yep, absolutely. How about a favorite internet resource? Is there anywhere you like to go on the web?
I tend not to do the internet quite as much. I do have some, although I do, you know, but I have some books. I really love Elliot Coleman's book, especially his Four Seasons Harvest. I really enjoyed that. Text reading that. We've recently been in reading a book called Miraculous Abundance, written by two farmers in France, Perrine and Charles, Herve Gruy. And it's just really, I don't know, we've really enjoyed their work.
Cool.
Lots of books I found. I've read Richard Wiswell's Business Handbook. That's been really good. I think I often go back to Elliot Coleman. He's an author that I was introduced to years ago, and it's really been good to kind of go back and revisit it and keep thinking about it. And yeah.
Yeah. That's a good standby around here too.
Yes.
All right. Ready for my final question. It's kind of a doozy. It goes, if there's one change you'd like to see, Rachel, to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Yes. I think there are many organizations which have really good causes, and they do, they have wonderful people working for them and helping to spread. But I think probably the one thing that I would say would really help at least a lot of Americans and probably a lot of the Western world is for people to just do some of their own gardening, start small, start with something that you think you can grow and you can manage well, and learn for yourself how to take care of your little spot of soil and how to grow some of your own food and how to share some of your own food with your family and your neighbors, and how to have dinners together with food that you've grown yourself. I think really connecting to the land in more ways than just where we live. It's where you live, but as you're feeding the land and the land is feeding you, it becomes a good friend. And I think that it helps on many different levels. We could talk probably for hours about it, but I really think that if more people tried to have their own little garden, maybe it's just garden in pots, or gardening in some kind of container, so they're doing it, they're working it themselves, and trying to ask other people about what kinds of things grow well in this area, and how do you, the slugs got into the lettuce series this year, what do you do about that? It's really helpful for connecting people to their communities and for connecting it to their land and for helping people, I think, to really care about the place where they're at, and also to be careful about the resources they have, careful about what they do with the water, and careful about what they do with their garbage and all those kinds of things,
I so know exactly what you're talking about. And so that's kind of why I have my little apartment garden as much for me is I'm kind of doing it like as a trial to see what other people, because urban farming has definitely been some of the popular episodes on my show. Some of the most downloaded ones are people who talk about the urban farming. And a lot of my listeners, probably as much because there's more people that live in cities. So you're going to have more listeners, but they're like, California, Texas, New York, Florida, the biggest places. And then as far as the world goes, it's kind of weird, but Russia is like number two. I'm like, oh, well, that's interesting. Like, those are the people that are going to my website, how to attract whatever attention. But yeah, it's been really weird. There's been like this big influx of people from Russia going, according to Google Analytics anyway. What people do at my website, I don't know, because like the bounce time is like a minute and a half. Like, nobody stays there very long. But, there's not much on my website except for the transcripts of the podcasts and the links to listen.
Right.
So maybe that's what they do. Maybe they go, they push play, and then that's why it's only a minute.
Right.
I don't know. Anyway, so that's interesting. But, I think that's so awesome. And I think if I can learn how to garden, anybody can, because when I was a kid, I definitely stayed as far away from my mom's garden as I possibly could, other than to eat the food that she grew in it. And but my husband has definitely turned on my love of growing. And in these last couple of years, I've just like been learning more. Well, what happened was last year I ran the garden club at my school, and then I also got a guinea pig for my class pet. And so then Mike set us up with these like little windowsill things, and the guinea pig food is what showed me how much we could grow, because boy, does that guinea pig eats way more lettuce than I do. I mean, he just like about ran me out of house and home. I was paying like $6 a day to feed the guinea pig in the classroom because lettuce was super expensive. Anyway, I'll quit talking and just, do you want to tell listeners how to connect with you, your guys' website, which is just awesome. And just thank you so much for sharing with us today. And just, I know listeners are going to love this episode.
Yeah. Thank you, Jackie. Thanks for visiting and asking good questions. And, yeah, I think if people would like to, they're welcome to go to the website, and there are ways of connecting with us there. And we're happy to meet with people or to visit with people, you know.
And it's just threeheartsfarm.com, right? Like T-H-R-E-E, I forgot, or is it the number three?
Yes. Yep. Yep. Spell out the number three. So T-H-R-E-E, heart, farm. Yep.
And how'd you come up with that name? Like, was it already named that, or did you guys come up with that, or what's the story with your name?
It has a really fun story. We didn't come up with a name. We didn't name the farm, but the man who started the farm, he was a professor in English studies, literature, and he was familiar with, I think, Native American cultures, and he said there's a tradition in Native American culture for a relationship in itself to have a heart. So in our relationship, you have a heart and I have a heart, and then the relationship itself has a heart, and so you call that the three hearts of the relationship. So that's the kind of the name. I think the idea is that we are growing produce, and we have members and friends and who support us and share our produce, and then we have that relationship itself as a heart as well for the farm. So
I love that. What a great way to end. Well, thank you so much, and I'm sorry to take you away from your kids and your family today, especially I'm sure you're busy, so you guys have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too. And yes, thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you as well.
Free the Seeds 2018 is March 3rd, Saturday, from 9 to 3:30 in the afternoon at the Flathead Valley Community College Arts and Technology Building, as it has been for the last 2 years. We're very excited. We've got some fabulous new workshops and additional booths at this event, and we're planning on distributing about 10,000 seed packets. So we're expecting a big crowd, and we want everyone to have a great time. And we've got a bunch of workshops on keeping chickens in today's world and beekeeping, how to garden like a farmer, all sorts of workshops on building your soil health of your garden, and how to convert your lawns to gardens with grace and ease. So lots of good stuff there. And if you want to volunteer, donate, or sponsor, just visit us at freetheseedsmontana.com.
The Organic Gardener Podcast is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like runners, gardeners, healthy eaters, strength trainers, and green future growers just like you get lower rates on their life insurance. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/OGP or mention the promo code OGP. When you talk to a Health IQ agent to save up to 33% on your life insurance. If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener Podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.